talk with all of you. As all of you have noticed from the program, conference program, that I'm not going to give a technical talk, but it's not a philosophical talk either. So it's going to be just easy and casual talk that hopefully will involve all of you. So let me give you some excuses for doing this. Actually, one of my collaborators planned to come to the conference from Beijing to present a technical talk on some of the works we did, robust principle component analysis. I even paid conference registration fee for him. But unfortunately, he couldn't make it, and it was too late for me to change my abstract. Hopefully, it's not too late to get the refund of the conference registration fee. So I decided to stick with the abstract that I submitted earlier. But most importantly, the main reason is that I have always been concerned with how to make robust methods more friendly, more accessible, and more useful to a broader group of statisticians and scientists. And I think, you know, doing research in robust statistics is very interesting, very challenging, and very, very nice. But I hope all of you will agree with me that it will be more rewarding if we see more and more people outside this room start using and appreciating robust methods. We all know that people in this room like it, use it. But if we are the only one in the world who are going to use and promote robust methods, well, it's still fine, but not as great, right? So in order for that to happen, in order to convince other people to use the methods we like, I think we ourselves have to play a very important role. And so what I'm going to do today is just basically start with myself. I'm going to just share with you some of the experiences I have working with other people and also offer some of my own views. But obviously my experience is just one person's experience. It's going to be very limited. And my views may be very subjective. So hopefully after a while, I'm not going to take all my time slot. After a while, hopefully you can jump in, you can add, subtract, multiply, or divide whatever I have to say, and we can, you know, share our experiences in this comfortable place in the beautiful city of Vancouver. It's kind of a little bit risky that I'm going to tell you what I think first before I know what you think, but I'm kind of prepared to remain calm even if you don't agree. If you disagree with me, please jump in, prove me wrong, and I think I'm not too old to change my views. So first of all, I want to start on a positive note. And I looked it up at the current index to statistics. Oh, I forgot from which year to which year. I think from the starting year it was available on current index to statistics, maybe in the 60s, somewhere in the 60s or early 70s, to the year 2000. I counted how many papers that were included in current index of statistics with certain keywords. And here are the ones that I looked at. Bootstrap. I found a little less than 2,000 papers. Density must be a pretty common word in statistics, right? Less than 3,000. Nonparametric has a lot more, between 4,000 to 5,000. And regression, amazingly, well, it's not surprising, over 10,000. So what would be the right count for robustness? What do you think?
7,000.
2,000? 5,000. 5,000. You know, what I guessed, I thought it would be just about 1 to 2,000. I found more than 4,000 of them. Obviously, I did a little trick. I have to find either robust or robustness. If you pick one of them, it's much lower. Okay, but that's still a pretty big number. I mean, it's almost, you know, very close to non-parametric, which has a longer history. I don't know whether it's, I mean, depending on how you define history, a lot of more people working on it. Now, you cannot compete with regression, but there are a lot of overlap between robustness and regression, actually. So this seems to be pretty well, reassuring that we are not alone, right? A lot of other people writing about robustness, even though they may be different type of robustness.
We are very productive. Yeah.
Right, that's another way to look at it. We are very productive. We even have conferences every year. So. We cite each other. Well, this doesn't include citation yet. Well, actually, I also look at the citation numbers. I think we should cite each other even more often. On that count, we were not well ahead of many others. For example, if you look at Efron's bootstrap paper, it was already been cited more than 1,000 times. But no paper in robustness has been cited that many times. Well, we also have some software to do it. Like S Plus is probably the first one that, you know, incorporate many of the robust methods that we have been developing. Not me, but many of, you know, we as for all of us, I guess. SAS, a little bit late, but I think Colin is going to show us at some point that SAS has incorporated all the many of the robust methods in the next version that's going to be released very soon. There are a lot of specialized softwares. I actually rarely use specialized software because I have to download from other people's website and test and see if it works. But there are a lot of them kind of around. So that's the kind of positive side. But mostly what I want to share with you is some of the problems and frustrations that I kind of have over the years working with people. I will start with non-statisticians. Complaints or criticisms about or resistance to using robust methods. This is a sample of what I have seen and heard kind of personally, on a personal level. Obviously, they don't sound very positive. But I didn't put positive ones in there. I mean, I've also seen some positive evidence. For example, one of the psychometricians is recently writing a book. I mean, he's already completed a book at low, you know, elementary to intermediate level statistics textbook. He actually had two or three chapters in the book devoted to robust methods. And the reason I know it hasn't, it's not published yet, the reason I know it is because I'm one of the reviewers for the publisher. Obviously, I wrote a very enthusiastic review, but hopefully the book will be coming out very soon. So if there are, you know, more elementary statistics books that also talk about robust methods, introduce robust methods to our students, maybe this all will change. But I'm not going to talk about all these positive developments. This first quote you can actually find on the web. One of the computer scientists actually, you know, obviously somebody, you know, who actually know what, at least to some extent, what know what we were doing. And he said, robust statistics does not always give us the solution to our problem. Well, that's true. It doesn't always give you the solution. But he gave a reason, a very specific reason, because robust methods have been developed only for some functions F. Or you probably don't know what, or you can guess what he meant. He meant that we often develop procedures that are robust at certain model that we pick, like a Gaussian model. So, like Huber's minimax, you know, M estimated, oh, we start with a normal model. So you always pick an F. That's normal. What if it's not normal? So it's a neighborhood of another distribution. We know we can do it, but we don't have explicit estimators for them to use. So I think that's a valid complaint. And maybe that can, you know, we have to think about that. Now, the second one is kind of interesting. When I talk about outliers, that these numbers maybe, I think it was my mistake to explain outliers in a way that I did. I said, well, outliers may be the ones that there was a mistake. I said, oh, it's wrong. Why should you use it? Why should you use it in the data set? And now this one is actually a scientist that I'm working with. Later on, I will actually give you a very specific example. And she was very open to the idea that I talked about, but she always worried about whether something is endorsed by the statistics community. I mean, can you cite papers in major journals? Of course, we could, but sometimes for a very specific problem, it's hard to find a specific reference to it. And one, you know, professor who submitted a paper to a social science journal came back with a referee report say, why don't you use something just already in SPSS? It's not there. The referees didn't quite believe it. But I think this may not be so unique. I mean, the referees are not statisticians. Even if they are statisticians, they may not agree to use a robust method. So it seems to me that it's going to be very, very important, very, very, very important that we have more software. You know, the robust methods will show up in popular software like SAS and SPSS. If they are there, fewer people will question the value, validity of those methods. If they're not there, they simply say, oh, why is it not there? If it's so good. Yeah, sure, yeah.
I think that the first point is a situation, but I think it's not unique to robustness, but to the way that we statisticians use to present our methods to other people. That is, I have experienced the same kind of response from engineers, for example, to whom I explain a quite different type of methods. Because we first think we need to know what we are estimating, and so we develop a model for that. But the model is actually only to explain what we want to estimate. But the audience thinks that the model is a requirement for the method to work, mm-hmm. which is quite another thing. And this may happen in different situations.
Right.
So we must distinguish between the actual conditions needed for the model to make sense and the conditions needed for our explanation
to work. Right. So actually, those complaints, resistance, are not, you know, baseless. I mean, they do have a reason.
Yes.
And we have to somehow respond to those issues. Anybody want to? Yeah.
I just want to add one thing. It reminds me to a comment by Steve Maron about non-parametric. It wasn't exactly, he had some other point, but basically it was the same kind of thing. So it just means that we are in good company. First of all, but this is not very reassuring, maybe. But basically it was saying the same thing about non-parametrics. And, you know, you get a lot of solutions, and people are used to one solution. Not all of them are in standard statistical mm-hmm. software, and things like that. They are developed for some type of problem, but not for very complex models. Mm-hmm. Also, in this meeting, we have some good example in that direction, and so on and so on. So, I don't think it's really typical of robust methods what you are.
Right. So it's not unique to robust methods. To many other methods under development, I think they are not quickly enough, you know, they are not quickly going into those software, and people hesitant to use them. So maybe we should push. Yeah.
Look what happened to data mining. You've got enterprise miner and SAS. And,
right.
And nobody can agree on the proper data mining mechanism, but you just branch. You have logistic, you have LEA, you have CART or whatever, and the branching is, you know, the whole analysis goes along like this, and then it splits, and you can do it three or four different ways, and then it merges back into all this. Somehow, that level of, I guess nobody's willing to pay that much for optional methods and alternate methods to analyze a particular model.
Mm-hmm.
It just hasn't been packaged.
Right. So it would be nice, even if it doesn't go to SAS or SPS, at least we allow other statisticians to use them. In order to do that, it would be nice if we have a centralized place where all the code that different people write are there, and you can easily find them. They are very well organized. At least if you have some statistical computing experience, you can use them. But right now, Ani is going to say, yes, there is a outlet. So,
Journal of Statistical Software is the place to publish code.
Right. Yeah, so that kind of thing will be extremely useful. So at least it's sitting somewhere that you can find it, and then you can use it.
You're a very sympathetic associate.
Well, more surprising to me is that actually I find that other scientists are more open-minded. They're quite willing to use robust methods once they kind of understand what we want to do, as I will try to show you later on with examples. But it's more difficult to look at those things. Again, this is just a sample of what I have seen. Most of you have seen it also, you know. I even talked to one of a very prominent statistician, and he just told me that a few outliers don't matter if you have a large data set, so don't bother. And then we have people saying the robust fits are not stable under certain circumstances, and you cannot find a solution in high dimensions. Well, they are true, probably. Sometimes people even say the algorithms keep changing. Seems like as if we cannot improve our algorithms. Minimax criterion breakdown, they are all too pessimistic, and so on. So, I mean, these are coming from smart people. These are people at least as smart as, if not smarter than I am. But so, you know, they are not nonsense. So it's something that has been bothering me, and probably many of you too. I don't have very good answers to many of those questions, but I kind of feel that maybe we are all too demanding. Now, it's true that sometimes a robust fit is not stable in certain under certain circumstances, but is there an estimate that's going to be stable, good, under all circumstances? And people sometimes question about non-uniqueness of our solution, especially if you use random start, you know, random subsets and so on. Well, your solution is not unique. I actually had the same complaint myself at one point, but then I realized as a statistician, we always live in the world of uncertainty. Why do we want something that's really unique? I don't know whether other people complain about, like, solution from MCMC algorithm, do people complain about non-uniqueness? I mean, if you run another MCMC chain, you get a different answer. Or Monte Carlo integration, I mean, you choose different seeds, you get different answers. So I don't know whether people complain about those. Maybe they also do. But it seems like that complaint, again, the same thing. It's not unique to the robust methods that we have been talking about. It happens everywhere in statistics. So why we have to be so picky about ourselves?
Try to explain that in a courtroom?
In a courtroom? No. Well, when people say we are too pessimistic, I kind of feel maybe, even if we are, but we don't want to be too optimistic either. It seems like non-robust methods are being too optimistic, you know, if robust methods are too pessimistic. I'm not going to defend ourselves. I don't have good defense, so you can help me with that, but basically, I feel that we do have our limitations. I mean, there are limitations to every method, so there are limitations to robust methods. The main question we should ask is whether a particular method solves all the problems. None of them will. The question is for a class of problems, whether you have better alternatives. Now, if somebody comes up with a better alternative, then a particular estimator we have been talking about, then we should take notice and say, okay, now you have a good solution. But if they only criticize us by saying, okay, this is unstable, this is that, it doesn't seem to help. Any better defense? It's tough to answer those questions. I've also been thinking about asymptotic distributions because I'm one of the people who have written papers on asymptotic distribution for robust estimators and stuff like that. And, you know, I have the most common criticisms of that is, well, robust methods are usually for small samples. Why do you study large sample properties? And also, the second one, the estimator that you compute, really is not the one that you are studying. So if you study very carefully, you know, asymptotic distribution and stuff like that, that's not the one that you are computing. Doesn't seem to make much sense. For small sample questions, well, I don't know how small is a small sample, so it's hard to argue. In some sense, it's true that robust methods are more useful, maybe more useful for small sample problems. But you have to, yeah.
I don't agree with that.
You don't agree?
Yeah, I think that when you have a very large data set, with a lot of variables and very complex data, mm-hmm. There is where robust methods are more useful because they will be able to find anomalies in the data that you cannot see
with your eyes.
So I think that this would be an answer.
Right, so Ruben has at least a different opinion that maybe robust methods are more useful in small samples.
Yeah, I agree with that also. Because there's a lot of things that don't where the problems don't automatically get solved by having large samples. And the simplest example is two clusters in high dimensions. There's no known method for automatically discovering those two clusters as the sample size gets bigger. We can have a sample size of a billion. Mm-hmm. And it actually isn't any easier to find the two clusters than it was when you have a sample size of 1,000. It's only for situations where you automatically get convergence with Kali and that robustness may be less useful for examples. And that's, there's lots of situations like that.
Okay, so it would be nice. I mean, at least people in this room feel differently, but it would be nice if we have real examples where we can show that, you know, it's a huge data set, but still the non-robust traditional methods give you things that you don't want, and the robust methods can help. I personally haven't seen one like that, but they must exist, right? I mean, if, I don't know whether the huge data sets, the data mining where people, probably a robust method will help. So, yeah.
Just a point about that, and you can say a little bit what you mean by large data set. I think it seems to me that the key is N over P.
N over P.
Not only N.
Right.
And so when you have this large data set, very often you have very large P as well.
Right.
And so you're still in the small.
Yeah, that was also my feeling, is that when people say small data, small sample, it's all relative. So I later on I'm going to show an example with 2,000 observations. Is it a small sample, a large sample, a moderate sample? I don't know. It's not too small. It's not too large. But you know, you will see where the classical method simply cannot cope with even a small fraction of outliers. And when people complain about, you know, you cannot really exactly compute an estimator you define, it seems to me like, well, we always have to start with a statistical model. The model is not going to be exact, so why do we do inference based on that model? So the same kind of question shows up. So, I say the model you use is not the model you want. Why still use it? It's not a really good analog, I guess, to this, but it's true that we can never exactly compute the estimator that we are studying. Like, for example, say MCD or a fast MCD algorithm doesn't really compute exact MCD in every situation. With probability one, it's not calculating the right MCD. So, well, we are studying the properties of MCD. Is that useful? At least approximately, I think it's useful. If it's really a small sample, maybe the asymptotic distribution, asymptotic variance, covariance matrix you derive don't provide you with a good approximation. I admit that. I mean, sometimes the asymptotic variance, covariance matrix don't provide a very good approximation to a small sample problem. Well, what do you do? Well, you can do bootstrap. Hopefully, bootstrap will do me better. But bootstrap itself doesn't always work. It works, you can be assured that bootstrap will work if you have asymptotic normal distribution. So in that sense, I feel it's still useful to derive the asymptotic normal distribution for that estimator so that you can use bootstrap. You have some justification for doing that. Okay.
It's not true that the computer estimators are different from the one that you would study. For example, for S estimators, you can start with the initial estimator computed by the sample, but then you can iterate using the weightless square, mm-hmm. and it's going to be an S estimator with all the asymptotic properties that you have studied. It will have the asymptotic properties, it will have the convex breakdown point, and therefore this is not different from the one that we studied.
Right. Yeah, so we can use a robust estimator as a starting point and then do something like one step or reweighted versions so that the asymptotic distributions apply.
Well, the statements on the last slide, they would correspond except for the first one, the statistics in general. This is not just the last
right.
one.
Right.
The second point is that if we search for popularity or lack of popularity of a certain methodology, I think it depends very much on the number of serious practical problems solved with this. Mm-hmm. And there I would search the main reasons for whether this is popular or if it can't be.
I agree. Yeah, I don't know how to find out how many times robust methods have been used in other areas. CIS is just a convenient way for me to do it.
We write our papers incorrectly. My machine learning friends at MIT would say, "All right, let's call it algorithm R,
uh-huh.
and we're going to have have test data. We're going to always have a test data set. We're going to have a number of data sets where each one we've held out a test data set. And we're going to run this algorithm. If the algorithm does better on the test data set in terms of whatever we're doing, then this looks good. And if I compare it with, you know, other machine learning methods, then this new method is a good method. So it's the pitch. We're always coming out with a distribution that we're on. And if you change the pitch and say, this is an algorithm, or look at this algorithm on these data.
And that works.
It works.
Yeah, I also find it to be a better way of convincing other people to use it. I mean, we like to use simulations, but simulations don't seem to make a good case among other scientists, because they're like, oh, this is just a scenario that you cook up with, doesn't correspond to my scenario. If we can show them that in your scenario it works better, they will be happy to accept it. So I'm going to go to two very specific examples where actually seems like I made a positive impact by using simple concepts from robustness. The first example is actually a very common measure of inter-rater reliability. That's intra-class correlation, right? And for this particular problem, what they are looking at is that they want, well, if you have a patient, a dysphagia patient, a patient with swallowing difficulty, and they want to find out a lot of things about you during the evaluation. So what they do is they feed you with something, like they feed you with liquid or something, and then you swallow it. When you swallow, they take all kinds of measurements. Okay? And one of the things, I just use an example, is apnea offset time. It's basically the duration of apnea. When you swallow something, you stop breathing. Maybe for a fraction of a second, or sometimes longer, depending on whether you have trouble with swallowing, right? And then when the liquid or the food goes down the throat, and then you start breathing again. Now, if you have a long apnea, it's a good indication that you have swallowing problems. It could be very dangerous. If you cannot breathe for half a minute, you know, it's going to be a problem. But how to determine the duration of apnea for a particular swallow? You cannot use a timer because it happens really quickly. So what the clinicians do is to look at the signals, like acoustic signals and some other signals. And, signals were like this. You know, something is happening, and then suddenly there was a very little thing and taking off again. So this period, I mean, this is a kind of ideal situation that you don't have anything going on. You kind of think that's a period, that's an apnea period. And you have the signal in front of you. Different people who evaluate your case will come up with different numbers. Okay, even though they are very well trained. So in this particular literature, the clinicians are very concerned about the reliability of a particular protocol that they use. I mean, you have to train people using a particular protocol, whether that protocol will provide reliable measurements from one clinician to another, one evaluator to another. It's a very interesting question. So what they use is intra-class correlation. So YIJ is the apnea offset time. AI refers to I subject. It's a random effect. It's a very simple random effect model. And EIJ, you know, it's the deviation due to the Jth evaluator. And intra-class correlation, or ICC, is simply a ratio of two variances. And it's actually related to this quantity, R, which is the ratio between inter-rater variability and inter-subject variability. I mean, it's a very simple measure. And the people I work with, they are always happy, and they, you know, most of the papers published in their literature, they always report a very high ICC values. Very high ICC values, close to one, means good. Very high reliability. Until one day, it turned out for another variable they looked at, they have a very low ICC measure, about 0.4. And then they question, oh, why? Why is this so low? Right? It turned out that those very high ICC values are not very trustable. Actually quite misleading. And if you look into the details, for example, this particular data set that I looked at, it's 3 raters and 32 swallows. Guess what? There's one person, before he swallowed, he held his breath. Maybe he was very nervous? Who knows? I mean, because he held his breath for a long time, what would happen? The inter-subject variability is huge. if the intersubject variability is huge, and that's in the denominator, I suppose, right? That's yeah. So then this R becomes very small. It's almost zero, and ICC is almost one. If I didn't look into it, if I didn't look at this particular outlier, you won't know. You'll say, oh, okay, it's good. It's, you know, ICC of 0.99. And actually, same thing happened for another variable that we looked at, why the ICC value was so low, because one of the evaluators moved a decimal when he input the data into the computer. So instead of, say, you know, instead of saying 35 milliseconds, then you say 350 milliseconds or something like that. Obviously, that makes the inter-rater variability very high. So that was kind of a very simple notion of robustness. If, you know, if you are not thinking about how outliers can affect your results, you will be happy with the numbers you get, but actually there might be a problem. And I don't know. I only have one data set. I don't know all those published results. When they publish very high ICC values, do they really have the same problem? So I'm trying to write, you know, a paper with my collaborator and try to publish in their area. I don't know whether it will be published or will be accepted for publication. Basically, by saying, oh, all the ICCs that you report may be quite questionable. But, you know, at least for this experiment that we did, it is true.
And there's a paper by Altman and Bland in the biomedical literature that's probably biostatistical literature that's worth looking at, I think, about
this issue.
Use that current index to stats.
Okay.
I'm sure you'll find it.
Okay, yeah. So, and that's the biostatistics literature, you said.
Yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. I think this will be easier to explain to a statistician or biostatistician, but when we are trying to explain it to clinicians, I...
But this paper is much quoted, isn't it?
Much quoted in the... Okay.
In fact, they may have written two, one for the statisticians and one for
okay.
the clinicians.
So I'll get the author's name from you, maybe. That will be very helpful. So, it seems like sometimes we have, you know, seems to me that's very satisfactory that you find something that will have an impact, even though it's so simple. Okay, you cannot publish it in any statistics journals. But if we more and more, you know, if we do this more and more often, it seems like we have a better and better impact. And maybe I think many of you are doing the same thing. And one example is if you look at Peter Rossell's website, and he has a lot of papers. You know, most of the papers I know that are in JASA, but he actually has a lot of other papers in applications. So we really have to do more and more of that. So what's the time?
You have about 6 minutes.
6 minutes. Yeah, I cannot go over time because the next speaker is our department chair. So. Now the second example is a little more complicated. This is a project that we are actually currently working on, trying to provide cost estimates for seismic rehabilitation of buildings. Okay. Traditionally, how do people estimate the cost of seismic rehab? Well, they will send an engineer who will inspect the whole building, collect data on many variables like building type, whether it's wood frame, steel frame, and so on. And of course, you need to know when it was built initially, how large the building is, how tall it is. A Sears Tower, obviously, is more difficult. Whether it's in downtown Vancouver or it's somewhere in Alberta, you know, that makes difference in terms of cost. And performance objectives, like why do you want to do this? And the rehab methods you're going to use, roof conditions, foundation, and so on. So the engineer thinks that these are relevant variables. The engineer will go there, do an evaluation. At the end, he will come up with a cost estimate. But the problem is, the cost estimate is actually what we call a structural cost. The reason they can really provide you an estimate of a structural cost is because the non-structural cost is really arbitrary, depending on what kind of carpet you're going to use and things like that. So they don't ask, you know, you have to decide on your own. The building owner has to decide on his own. However, the reality is, if you send two different engineers to do the cost estimate, even from the same firm, they're going to give you very different cost estimate. You cannot believe how different they can be. So FEMA, which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, it's a federal government agency, wanted us to develop a model statistically so that we can use the information engineering provides to do a cost estimate. Actually, most of the information the two engineers will give you are very similar, but the cost estimate is just very subjective. The data we have has more than 2,000 buildings. That's what I'm saying, whether it's small sample, large sample, I don't know. Not too small, I guess. And the traditional method will be just look at a linear model on cost, but cost is very, it's a very skewed distribution, so we all know to take log. So we look at log scale, and we can do it very easily in SAS. We did it in SAS, but the prediction interval turns out to be huge. How big the prediction, a typical prediction interval will be? If you look at the upper end of the prediction interval and lower end of the prediction interval, even for 50% confidence, so 50% prediction interval, okay, upper end, lower end, the division is usually 5 or more. So if your estimate is $10, the prediction interval, 50% prediction interval will be $5 to $25. That's not very useful, right? So, I mean, why does that happen? Well, in the early stage, we kind of found out that actually there are 20 buildings with very huge cost. Well, 20 out of 2,000, but still, you know, it's a very small fraction. But for some reason, the structural cost is over $300 per square foot. I think even in downtown Vancouver, you can build one with less cost. But a typical one is $10 per square foot. So, you know, you have to know why. Maybe they're wrong numbers, but usually they're not. They're not wrong numbers. Just for special reasons, they're very expensive. And we know the least squares tries to strike balance between the majority of the data and those outliers, so we came up with a compromise. Most importantly, I think these two issues. The variable selection itself, we have to use variable selection because there are a huge number of variables, those categorical variables, you recode them into binary, we end up with more than 150 variables. So that selection itself is very sensitive to outliers. And how do you do prediction intervals? Well, you calculate mean square errors. The mean square errors are inflated by those outliers. So our first solution is to eliminate all those buildings that cost over $100 per square foot. They're outliers, maybe. But then the buildings that cost over $50 show up and they seem to dominate or cause problems. Well, we try to eliminate all those buildings over $50 per square foot. We can keep doing it until you realize your data set gets smaller and smaller. And seriously, you are removing good leverage points this way. So it seems to me that we really need a robust regression software. I don't have it. I don't know how to do it easily because we have to do variable selection. I mean, we have a robust regression software, but doesn't do automated variable selection. So if we have to sit down there, manually do backward selection from 150 variables down to 50 variables, I would be very bored. I mean, so what we are using right now is CART. Regression tree, I have, because of time constraints, I'm going to skip all this. Remember, when we use CART, they have two options, least squares and LAD. They give you totally, completely different trees. So in this case, we are using LAD option. Here's a little bit the kind of experience I had with all those engineers. You know, I tried to convince them that you cannot fit all the data very well. There are going to be buildings you cannot predict very well, especially those very expensive buildings. Okay? You just don't have enough information in your sheet, the variables that you have collected information on cannot tell us which one is going to cost $400 per square foot. So instead of trying to accommodate everybody, you should try to accommodate the majority of the data. Well, we learn from robust methods. Their initial response is, how can we ignore the minorities? I mean, we cannot ignore the minorities. But very quickly, you know, they told me, oh, it's fine if you can find a better prediction interval for 75% of the buildings. So very quickly, they kind of go with me. And at the end, even before I made suggestions, they came up with suggestions and said, whoa, these outliers must be very important. We should look at them and collect more data on them. So give me an outlier list. And then, so at the end, it seems like the engineers think more or less the way that I do. Here's the conclusion. I'm not going to go through it. I would rather hear what you have to say.
Okay, thank you.
Any remarks?
Yes.
I'm more of a practicing statistician. I'm a biostatistician. I've always been a fan of robust methods and been disappointed that it hasn't been taken up more.
One comment is that I think we're all too preoccupied with parameters in general and stuck to particular parameterizations that may not be helpful. For instance, in that problem on reliability that you mentioned in the app problem, Murray mentioned that paper by Bland and Ullman. They solved the problem by saying you really shouldn't be interested in that, you know, variance ratio anyway, because it's really not very meaningful. Similarly, in the case of isolated or complete separation and logistic regression, whereas physicians often come in saying they want those odds ratios, typically they're totally unable to interpret them in any meaningful way. And I actually would like to personally stamp out the use of odds ratios in any logistic regression because they are so often misinterpreted and misused. So I mean, I think, you know, we're all tempted to, you know, look at the problem in the standard way, and we have to go realize that people don't usually even ask the right questions. And the problems are more interesting than we even think.
But there's some idea about the problems to convince people to use robust methods. And I got this idea as I saw your first example of swallowing. And I think there's a large psychological problem. And this problem is that robust statisticians always are troublemakers. If the problem is tackled with some classical method, then there's always a number coming out, there's always an answer coming out. Robust statisticians are usually concerned with situations in which there are classical alternatives. These are established, these are taught, and there are scientists who propagate these things. So a robust statistician now can say, okay, there's a mistake coming from this or that problem in the design of the experiment. And if you would use a robust method, then you could get rid of this kind of problem. But as you said, there are some other stability problems and some robust methods. So what I wanted to say is, well, we should believe that a scientist is always distanced enough to his own work that he is possible to say, okay, there's a mistake in here, and I will take a method which is able to tackle this more adequately. But my experience is that usually this is not the case, and one of the greatest problems is we come and say, there's a mistake, something stupid is going on there, and many persons don't want to hear that.
One last comment.
I just wanted to let you know there's an article by Bruce Brown of the University of South Australia that's appearing in, I think, the Australian New Zealand Journal of Statistics. The last
great journal. Sorry? That's a great journal.
Yeah. And it's he deals with exactly with these issues because he's concerned about the fact that robustness hasn't caught on, and that even he asked the same question about other areas of statistics, and the title of his article is The Importance of Being Smooth, and it's all about smoothness, and if the estimators don't have smooth properties, they're very hard to sell to the public. Anyway, I invite you to look at that.
Okay, so the Australian New Zealand Journal of Statistics. Yeah. I kind of feel that when I work on personal level with another scientist, it's easier to convince him or convince her to use robust ideas. But otherwise, it seems to be quite difficult. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you again.